ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for tuning in, Red Ice TV. My name is Henrik. It's good to have you with us today. We are going to revisit the situation of what it is that's happening in Saudi Arabia. There's been tremendous shakeup in the country recently with, of course, the ascendancy of Mohammed bin Salman. He has done a lot of changes so far. He's even expected to become the king, supposedly. This is yet to be verified by official accounts. But it all seems to suggest that it is something that's coming. So we'll just have to see, and we'll just have to see how this develops. We have with us on the line Patrick LeBrun to kind of help us break down what has happened in Saudi Arabia and what this means in the bigger picture for the region, because if we have any inclination, any ideas of what it is that is to come, we can just look at the situation both in Qatar but also in Yemen, Patrick, in terms of the fact that they tried to pin one of these supposed missiles that was launched from Yemen on Iran, and it seems that there is a coalition of powers being formed to position Iran in the worst situation possible. We might even be looking at war, but I think sanctions is obviously very very close out the gates. But help us break this down, Patrick, and thank you for coming on again, by the way. It's great to have you with us. But how do we understand the situation of what it is that's happened in the Middle East?
Yeah, I'm very happy to be here again. Thank you. Well, basically, this is a passage of power from one generation to the next, and the transition of Saudi Arabia from a consensus-based approach within the Saudi family, the larger Saudi family, which includes, I think it's over 5,000 princes, male princes, and which has, it all comes down to descendants of the most recent king who are in line for the throne, more or less, Abdulaziz ibn Saud, who died in 1953. Yeah, that's an excellent image there to see just how many there are.
Tons of them. It's amazing.
These are all princes of the blood. And so getting them all to agree on the direction of the country, trying to modernize the state is quite difficult with this group. But if they can focus power in one person, their hope is that they can make the necessary reforms that have been put off so that they can hold on to power for another generation, which is not actually that clear. And they've actually been going from failure to failure diplomatically in the region. And so, this is actually, in some sense, are acts of desperation, not acts of strength that are going on right now, including he's detaining a number of his relatives in the Ritz-Carlton Hotel. Just after the big opening of the announcement about NEOM, which you covered very well on Red Ice Radio earlier. And he used that very same hotel in that event as a ruse to pull them in and arrest them, as well as the head of the Saudi bin Laden construction group, right, that Osama bin Laden is descended from.
That's right.
And he also apparently kidnapped for a time the prime minister of Lebanon. And that may be the focus for their next either war in the region or their next blunder, perhaps.
Let's talk a bit about that then and see what, there's so many things going on, with these potential false flags to try to pin this on Iran and stuff, but we'll get to that later. But, yeah, what happened with the Lebanese prime minister? There was people pointing out the fact that someone made the comparison. It would be like Trump taking off, go to Mexico and denounce or resign as the president and having a prepared statement,
right,
which like, I don't know, with Spanish words in there or something like that. It's like very bizarre. How do we interpret that? What happened? How did the Saudis have this on the Lebanese prime minister?
Right. So Hariri, he's the son of a previous prime minister who was assassinated. They are basically the leaders of the Sunni community. The Sunnis have the monopoly on the prime ministership, while the Christian community has a monopoly on the presidency in Lebanon to resolve the sectarian tension in the country. Now, unlike previous Sunnis who've had that role, he and his father are very, very pro-Saudi, which is no surprise because they have millions upon millions of dollars in family wealth in Saudi Arabia. And Saad Hariri grew up in Saudi Arabia. He's a dual passport holder, and actually, he, as we're seeing here, this is oldest son with him visiting Macron after his detainment in Saudi Arabia. His other two sons actually remain behind. the hope seems to be to throw the country into chaos and to have Lebanon be the scene of the next war, of the next collision, the next proxy war between Saudi Arabia and Iran. And the interesting fact is that the fact that his two sons are still in Saudi Arabia, the day of that visit, I looked at Reuters, I looked at a number of other English news sites, and I did not see that fact mentioned. And I did see it mentioned in French language press. And only recently have I seen it on RT and Press TV in English. And when you think about the fact that the U.S. State Department is basically setting up the legal framework to make it easier to shut down those sites, forcing them to register as foreign agents, you know, it tells you that the oligarchy that controls the press, the deep state that controls the department, the State Department, that they don't want Americans to have the whole story when they make decisions about whether to support war or not, or when they decide who's really the axis of evil, who are the actors who are evil in the world, and who are the actors that are not so evil in the world.
Yeah, let's remind people about that too. I mean, Russia is evil because they have relationships with Iran, and this alliance now that's occurring between, you know, America, Saudi Arabia, Israel, they want to take Iran down, and so, you know, any power that's cooperating with them, making it easier for them to kind of exist in the world and remain relevant with deals and trade and all that stuff, those are deemed enemies. So Russia is a big problem for them in this equation.
Exactly. Yeah, the oligarchy has made an enemy of Russia. And also, I think it's, you know, so important for Americans to have the whole story before they make a decision. I mean, this is the most powerful country in the world still. And so, you know, the lives of many more than just those who live in America depend on the politics of America. And so it's really, I think for me, a reminder of how important independent news sources like Red Ice or like these others are. And so, you know, I encourage everybody out there to continue to support Red Ice and other independent news sources, because without that, I mean, there's really going to be a brick wall between Americans and the whole truth.
Oh, definitely, exactly. It's like an information embargo right now with all the censorship that we're seeing, not only on the social media platforms, but just a complete banning and blacklisting on search engines and stuff like that. That's been, we don't have to go too deep into this, but it's a good point that you raised this, because there are these, you know, Google, of course, and some of the bigger kind of go-betweens between the information that's out there and you who's searching for it. If they don't flat out just remove things from search engines and things which are disapproved, they basically try to say, well, these sources are fake news, or you can't trust this. And I think InfoWars, for example, just make one example, have basically partially been dragged into this just because they link to, you know, Sputnik News and RT occasionally and stuff like that. So that's how vehement they are, and they try to discredit this. So this whole fake news thing is very much tied into all of this. So basically make sure that it's only their version of what's happening that's going to be approved, and that's the one that people are going to get access to, and it's very dangerous.
Right, that's right. So what does the oligarchy want us to believe? I think that they want us to believe that Hariri really is under threat of assassination by the Shia, and that this is all at the orders of Iran, and that we need to have sanctions or even military intervention against Hezbollah, or perhaps Israel should get that green light in order to do this, or maybe even Saudi Arabia will actually fly their jets over there and bomb. But the thing is, for these air wars to actually bomb important military targets like the missiles that they have hidden throughout in fixed positions in their mountains in the south of Lebanon, the only way for them to successfully hit these is with good intelligence. You know, your air war is only as good as your intelligence that picks the targets. Now, Saudi Arabia does not have that quality of intelligence, and certainly the military of Lebanon is not going to share that information with them, even their friends in the Sunni community. I believe that if they do have any effective bombing, we would have to assume that this is coming from Israeli intelligence.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, exactly. And I mean, they have some of the state of the art, you know, technology. Basically, they have an ability to do this. And then also, of course, their they're unscrupulous. They have a chutzpah, as they say, right? I mean, they go after anything, and they bomb everything, as you've seen in other instances. They don't care. They throw white phosphorus on Palestinians, despite the fact that it's a violation of the Geneva Convention and stuff like this. So they will, I think, do any means necessary to hit their targets, Patrick, and they don't have any principles, you know?
Absolutely, yeah. And as you pointed out in our discussions before the show, that, you know, the Israeli military is openly discussing this now. Their Minister of Defense is openly saying that he would rather have ISIS on the borders, rather than Iranian proxies, right?
That's amazing. Amazing.
Yeah. And that I think there was someone else that you pointed out who I think you go ahead and take the you had mentioned there was another one who made one of these similar statements about sharing info with the
yeah it was actually the Israeli military chief that had basically he was doing an interview to Saudi media and he was actually I mean if they're a point where they say that they're ready to share intel on Iran. I think that they are sharing intel on Iran, you know, already. It's just to make it seem that it's like, well, we were communicating and talking to each other. But it's on par with these stories that we have getting out that, Bin Salman and Jared Kushner have been meeting. There have been talks between the two countries in a way that they're like, you know, on very, very good terms, basically, right? That there has even been secret talks between Saudi Arabia and Israel. Where Bin Salman went to go meet Netanyahu. So we have to assume that if they're starting to target Iran and looking at the same targets here, they are definitely sharing information and they are going to team up in a way that we haven't seen before.
Yeah, yeah. And if they're willing to share information on Iran, they're also willing to share information on Hezbollah in southern
Absolutely.
Lebanon. And this is a country or part of a country that Israel occupied for a couple decades. And
that's right.
Tried it again back in 2006 and failed. In fact, I think it's interesting to draw maybe certain parallels. I mean, imagine if Israel did in fact invade again into Lebanon, and imagine if somebody's reaction, some identitarian were to collect the locations of Jewish residents and Jewish community organizations and synagogues and just print them out. And then the day that war is announced, the day that the bombs start dropping, go to those refugee centers and start passing out those pieces of information and encouraging interfaith dialogue, right? what would happen? I wonder what would happen.
Yeah.
Well, not so different of a situation happened with Israel and Lebanon. They were basically in charge of refugee camps, multiple refugee camps. And what Israel did in particular, the most famous of these is in Shabra and Shatila. They basically opened the doors to Lebanese militias, and they just mercilessly massacred by the thousands the people in these refugee camps, men, women, and children. And these were not the kind of phony refugees that you see in Europe that are mostly military age men. These
right.
were really family,
women, children, yeah,
children, elderly. And not only did they open the doors to allow it to happen and stand aside when it was happening, they actually shot flares into the sky all night long so that it would make it easier for the low-tech militias to continue the job of finishing off every last refugee in the refugee camps.
I mean, it's such double standards. It's just it rages me beyond, that they can... They have this behavior and do this stuff, and then they moralize to the rest of the world what we have to do with refugees and saving everyone and all this stuff. It's amazing, and no one points it out. This stuff, people don't remember this stuff. It's not in the consciousness of people of what they've done or even how Israel was formed and the Irgun and the terrorism which they came into existence with,
You're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. They basically have created a new civic religion that has a temple in every city, and that because of what happened in the 1940s, this gives a moral green light to any kind of crime against humanity.
That's right.
And that's really a horrible thing. And I think I think that the tide is turning, honestly. And even if it's not reflected in the media that they mostly own, I believe the tide is turning amongst most people in even in the West. And it's just a matter of time before they're bad, unjust behavior catches up with them. And the fact is that, you know, in 2006, when they tried to invade Lebanon again, Hezbollah made a really kind of miraculous transition that is rarely seen. That is that they made the transition from a kind of ragtag militia that does, you know, random, you know, one-off attacks, to being an actual conventional military, that they were able to hold their ground and stop all of these tanks invading. They were incredibly successful. They even had one piece of military material that they got from China that they were able to take out an Israeli intelligence ship with out at sea. And it was, you know, just took a six-man team to blow it up. They've actually created videos about how they did it, celebrating their success. But, you know, they've really made that transition from just guys running around house to house with AKs or setting off pipe bombs to being an actual military. When the Syrian civil war happened, then they went initially just to Shia villages that were under threat from al-Nusra Front, mm-hmm. that were just across the border, and they engaged in regular conventional military tactics, and they were quite successful. They were even, you know, before the Arab Spring happened, for about 5 years, there was kind of a honeymoon period in the Arab world that at least I saw, where sectarian differences matter a lot less because Hezbollah stopped the Israelis, because Hezbollah was the resistance. And I think a lot of the way that the Arab Spring was handled, that it was reacted to by the counter-revolutionary governments like that of Saudi Arabia and others, was to give it a sectarian character. And also that was helped along by you know, false flag attacks by the British military in Basra in the south of Iraq, you know, creating sectarians, or say exacerbating sectarian tensions, and eventually having a full-out sectarian civil war in Iraq.
Right. Yeah.
And, you know, and that was not an accident. That was in response to this kind of coming together of opinion and about Hezbollah and Iran. And now it's coming to the point where, you know, the Arab League has the meeting the 20th, right?
Yes.
It's late at night.
Yep.
It's still the 20th. But yeah, we're staying late in the night to bring you the news here.
That's right.
But earlier today, the foreign ministers of the Arab League had an emergency meeting in Cairo. And I thought, oh, great, they got together to talk about the kidnapping of a head of government. This is super important. They should talk about this. No, it wasn't about that. It was about the Saudi foreign minister called the meeting and was saying that every Arab capital is under threat from the bombs of Iran and that we have to do something about this.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Now, today as well, what happened was that the heads of state of Turkey, the foreign ministers of Turkey, Russia, and Iran also had a meeting. And so Turkey seems to have made a very quick transition. You know, they were supporting ISIS. They were arming ISIS across the border. They were caught on video doing it. And they were murdering, they were murdering journalists who were uncovering it. And now they've made a really an about face in a detente with Iran and with Russia as well. So, yeah, and the person we're seeing here is the foreign minister of Lebanon, who also really encouraged others to kind of intervene and help free Hariri, essentially. He is, you know, the politics in Lebanon is very clannish. He's actually the son-in-law of the president, the Christian president, Michel Aoun. Now, his response and the response of the Lebanese, I think, was really, really impressive to me. And that is that, you know, these people were shooting at each other, you know, just 20 years ago. They were dragging, 30 years ago, they were dragging artillery up in the mountains to try and blow up each other's villages. And now, you know, an outside power is trying to create a proxy war in their country. And despite all their differences, the Lebanese people have really come together on this and refuse to be, you know, utilized in this way. I mean, it takes two to tango, but if you want to make a proxy war, you really need three or four different parties involved. And it seems that the Lebanese, just their memories of the bad times of the Civil War are such that they don't want it to happen. They've suffered a lot economically as a result of the Syrian Civil War. They have about 1.4 million refugees Their GDP per capita has, you know, sunk back down slowly since the beginning of the war, back to 2006 levels. So, you know, imagine, you know, not a single, if every job created from 2006 to today were to disappear. You know, that's the situation that their economy is.
Pretty bad. Yeah, pretty bad. Are they surprised that Hezbollah, like, popped out and got the support that they did? Are they surprised by that? I mean, of course they did. And now it's become morphed into a political party that is democratically elected to, right?
Yeah, it's a democratically elected party. I mean, I've seen some reports in the West that there is, that people aren't unhappy in the south of Lebanon because of the losses from the Syrian civil war and all these, you know, Lebanese Shia, you know, their sons and nephews and grandsons who are going off to fight and die there. Now, that's an all-volunteer militia.
Amazing.
And, you know, so they're trying, I think they're just making this up, that, you know, there's really not that kind of negative feeling, and they really feel like they have their backs against the wall as well. Like everybody, like each community in Lebanon feels this way. And certainly the Shia did when they see ISIS, you know, doing the kind of, you know, mass murder of other religious minorities. So they really, it has a lot of support. And it's an all-volunteer militia. These people are not drafted to go.
No.
And so, yeah, they still have a great deal of legitimacy in the eyes of their supporters. So if you want to erase Hezbollah, you have to erase the people who support them.
That's right, and that's why they're going after them with force. And so this, you know, this is a first step, obviously, in this larger grand scheme of eventually going after Iran and basically gaining full control of the Middle East, the entire region. And I think if the relationship between Saudi Arabia and Israel is developing in the way it is, mm-hmm. they're obviously even more likely to achieve this soon. But this could turn extremely volatile very, very, very quickly, frankly, depending on the developments, what happens here, and the responsibility that all of these nations
absolutely.
Have as well. Because, I mean, this could trigger, yeah, Saudi Arabia, oil prices could plummet, this could trigger recessions. There's like a domino effect of things that could happen if things go bad in the Middle East.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, in addition, you know, Lebanon is really dependent on remittances and foreign direct investment. Yeah, remittances are almost 20% of their GDP, and foreign direct investment is like 2 or 3%. It's like super high, right, compared to other countries. Because they have this diaspora of people, you know, all around the world who are just very good at doing business. So the richness of Lebanon is really in its human capital. And so, you know, they have all of these emigres who are, you know, say, all these Sunni in Saudi Arabia who are running retail chains or, you know, running other kinds of businesses there. You have, you know, the Christians who are really spread around the world, in particular in West Africa. You know, they're kind of a market-dominant minority in the port cities of West Africa. Carlos Slim, one of the richest guys in the world in Mexico. His full name is Slim, is short for Slimani. You know, he's a Lebanese guy. And so, you know, one of the things that they all do is that they then reinvest back in their country of origin, and they send money back to their family there to support them. And now, my thought is that what's even more likely than planes flying over Lebanon and dropping bombs is some kind of financial warfare against Lebanon itself. If they were to cut off their access to international banking, I mean, that would cut off the remittances from them, and it would make it incredibly difficult for that money to get back there.
Yeah.
If they were to do any, you know, shut down the ports, any of these things, That would really, really hurt the people of Lebanon. And their goal is to create chaos in Lebanon. You know, they failed in Qatar to diplomatically isolate Qatar. They failed in Yemen in this civil war. And so they're just trying again in Lebanon to start something fresh. So,
yeah.
And it all goes back to this transition of power in Saudi Arabia.
Yeah, exactly. That's where it hinges on, and bin Salman and what he's going to do, the support he's given, and everything. We've seen a micro version, I guess, of this with how Saudi Arabia has been treating Qatar, and it was interesting. It was actually, I believe, it was a foreign minister on television in Qatar that was talking about kind of what we're talking about here a little bit, that the forces supporting ISIS and making sure that they're basically retain the position that they do in the region is due to Saudi Arabia, Israel, America, and Turkey, I believe he said. There has been tight tensions between Qatar and Saudi Arabia for some time. What's the nature of that, Patrick? Do you know why are they on bad blood with each other?
Yeah, well, I mean, really, yeah, it's true. They're all letting the cat out of the bag as they get angrier and angrier. Yeah, it's yeah. So that actually, if people are really interested in depth on that, I did a podcast at the end of the summer. I think it was called "The Qatar Connection and the End of ISIS" over at Countercurrents, and that was really in depth on that diplomatic crisis. But basically, you know, the GCC is the Gulf Cooperation Council. These are all of the other Gulf countries, and you know, so it's, yes, from Oman all the way up the Gulf to Kuwait. And the goal of Saudi Arabia is to be the hegemonic power at least over the GCC countries, and then to project power beyond into the region and to ensure there are no enemies on its borders.
Mm-hmm.
And so Qatar has really been going its own way. And you know, diplomatically, they've been also supporting all sides. They've been sending money to ISIS. They've been, you know, they run Al Jazeera, which at one time will have a very popular show with the head, who's I guess you'd say a spiritual leader of the Muslim Brotherhood, is on it. And at the same time, they're also supporting liberal Democrats and social Democrats who are trying to create these Arab Spring revolutions. And so they're a source of instability and a supporter of change, and they are also building a Turkish military base in their country. So the Turks presumably were the ones defending them if the Saudis ever tried to invade.
So they're on good terms. That's interesting, yeah. So Turkey has, as you said then, they're a strange player, I have to say. Erdogan and Turkey is a very strange player because they seem to play both sides sometimes, don't they?
They do indeed, yeah, because he's inherited a NATO member country that has strong relations with the United States and has had strong relations with Israel, which was, you know, unique amongst Muslim countries. And he is, however, a Muslim Brotherhood operative. I once had tea in the living room of a guy who was a Muslim Brotherhood guy he was from Lebanon. And he very proudly pulled out a picture book to show me when he met Erdogan in the 1990s and talked about how they were, you know, Muslim Brothers, and they met through the Muslim Brotherhood Network and this kind of thing. And then in the way that Turkey projects power is largely through these Muslim Brotherhood networks in other countries. So, yeah, and if you watch, they have actually launched their own kind of their own RT, right? It's TRT is the Turkish news in English. And if you've watched it in the last couple of weeks, you'd see them just going, repeating the same line, that regional issues should be resolved by regional players. You know, they want to return to being a hegemonic power in their area as well. So that puts them at loggerheads with the United States, with Saudi Arabia, with Israel, and hence the strange bedfellows of them meeting with Russia and Iran today.
Yeah, and then the ISIS support is kind of bizarre too. Them that if Israel is like, we'd rather, you know, have ISIS on our border than Iran, and if the relationships there are cush, then that's been an interface with Turkey too. At least we've heard that they've been funding ISIS. They, you know, made sure that some of their operatives and commanders are taken care of and you know, sent to hospital and stuff like that. So
right.
Again, yeah. Two-faced. Right?
Exactly, yeah. Yeah, if al-Nusra Front fighters got hurt in the south of Syria, Israel was there to cross the border and bring them to hospitals in Israel.
Yeah.
It's, yeah, the goal of Israel is to have weak countries all around them so that they feel safe. Weak countries with poor governance structures, with divided populaces, and no nuclear weapons. And so for them, you know, these kinds of backwards monarchies work out just fine.
Yeah.
These kinds of, you know, Islamist states work out just fine. What they don't like are, you know, united Arab nationalists who are very modern. They don't like legitimate, strong states like you have in Iran. I mean, Iran is not a dictatorship. It's a democracy.
Well, not if you listen to the American media, right? I mean, they've started the drumbeat of war right now of like how Iran are bad and they're doing all these things. They're funding Hezbollah. They're funding Yemen. That's another big issue here that we should talk about, too. Yemen and how Saudi Arabia have been treating them. And it was actually Bin Salman that was behind starting that war. He was, if we were to believe those sources, almost individually responsible for doing that as kind of one of his pet projects to take out another competitor in the region, basically. But tremendous humanitarian crisis there, outbreaks of diseases. They're not getting food and medicine and stuff like that. And we don't hear much about it. That Saudi Arabia, as Israel, are getting a free pass in the international media.
Absolutely, yeah, yeah. Saudi Arabia has, you know, when they failed to stop the Houthis, right, from controlling the area they live in, and the areas around that, their capital Sana'a, and basically splitting the country back roughly along the lines that it was split for much of the 20th century between North and South Yemen. They decided to intervene militarily there with other GCC countries. They've killed over 10 million civilians at one point in the process.
Wow.
And were just really obviously failing to defeat these people in the mountains there with their, you know, guerrilla tactics. What they ended up doing, though, what they were good at, was dropping bombs on water treatment facilities, on, you know, heavily populated civilian areas. And so basically, you know, there has been the largest cholera outbreak in recorded history over the past year. And really, you know, thanks to the Red Cross and the WHO, it didn't end up being much more deadly than it was, but there were around 1 million cases of cholera. It seems to have been, gotten under control, but it was really quite a horrible humanitarian disaster. And yeah, it's just not covered. It's just one of those countries that, you know, people don't pay attention to.
No.
And it was not, and it's, yeah, the culpability for this really lies at the feet of the Saudi regime.
Yeah, and again, it's been Salman, you know, and this has been going on for many, many years now, and they're not managed to kind of defeat them one way or another. So it just kind of drags on and lingers on. And I remember BBC were talking about it, and they were like, when they're talking about this great liberal reformer, Bin Salman, they were like, oh, well, he did one blunder. He started that war in Yemen, and I guess he shouldn't have done that. It was like, whoop-de-doo. Like, talk about getting a free pass. I mean, but the Houthis, they pose enough of a threat to Saudi Arabia in terms of, I mean, do you know if there's other resources there that they want? I mean, if they could, they would just ethnically cleanse that whole group and just take over the region, right? I mean, is that the goal? Or
That is absolutely it. They cannot stand the presence of Shia. And unless they are on their knees and disarmed and doing, you know, manual work for them.
Yeah.
The Houthis are a people who, and actually there's another podcast I did as well on Yemen, on this series. It's basically a white nationalist guide to the Middle East that I'm doing over at Countercurrents. And I go into great detail about the Yemeni civil war that's going on now. But the fear is that the Houthis will be to Saudi Arabia what Hezbollah is to Israel,
right?
Which is a well-armed, highly unified and loyal group of Shia on their border who have a strong relationship with Iran and who would prevent them from just doing whatever they want, right? Israel has been held in check for a decade now because Hezbollah proved themselves in the 2006 war. And the fear is that the Houthis would one day do that as well. And all the Houthis want is exactly what Hezbollah has, which is to live in a democratic and pluralistic democracy, with the rule of law, where, you know, they're not seeking secession and they're not seeking to have dictatorial powers over their neighbors because they know that that's not the way to peace and stability. You can't have a 30% religious minority ruling over Shia and hope that you can have a peaceful country.
Mm-hmm.
Their approach have basically what Lebanon has been in its at its best, right? A peaceful, prosperous, pluralistic parliamentary democracy. And the Saudis don't like that. Saudis are, they're the counter-revolution, you know. That's basically it.
Yeah, exactly. And, of course, they thrive on instability, internal instability in many of these countries, too, so that the more they can fund little groups or rebel groups. And, I mean, if Syria is most recent on people's minds, I think, in that department. But that's stuff like that has happened in most of these Middle Eastern countries, with different groups being funded and, you know, the white helmets on this end, and there's Western, powers there. They're funding certain groups and stuff like that. So it's a mess, and it's difficult for us to understand.
Yeah, it is. Very complicated. You know, one thing I've said before when you mentioned, you know, little groups, is that, you know, Western intelligence agencies love Sunnis as proxies.
Yeah.
Because they, all you have to do is get a small group of people together, point to a couple lines in the Quran and say, all right, guys, this is telling you to go, you know, smite the necks of the enemies. Go do it, right? But if you were to try and infiltrate a Shia group, I mean, you'd have to find somebody first who has a good aristocratic lineage that goes to the prophet. You'd have to have have them go to a prestigious university, right? In Qom or in somewhere, one of these major religious centers for the Shia. Study for years and then come back and then start a group. You know, it's just like, It's impossible to create, to infiltrate, to run one of these kinds of organizations for the Shia, just because of the way that they work culturally speaking, with their hierarchical attitudes, their preference for aristocracy in a certain sense of the word, and clericalism. Whereas with Sunnis, it's really just about your direct relationship with Allah and your reading of the Quran and recreating the life of Muhammad and his followers and his first generation of Sahaba. You know, that is the essence of the Wahhabi Salafi approach. And so it's incredibly easy to manipulate people in this framework, this theological framework. And so Western intelligence agencies love these radical Sunnis because they're so much easier to manipulate from the outside.
Interesting. And then, of course, we have, you know, maybe this is taking off on a tangent, but, you know, we have to keep in mind what kind of immigrants are we getting in the West, too. Are they Sunni? Are they Shia? Or, you know, in some cases, they are fighting with each other in our countries. Like, we think in Germany, the Kurds and the Turks are, like, at each other's throats, and it's just a mess. But what we know is that the Saudi Arabians were, of course, the way that they were helping, so to speak, with the refugee crisis was to offer to build mosques in the West, you know?
Right.
And so if the West also wants to flood us, I guess they would want to do that with Sunni people, because they would be, as you say, much more easier to kind of turn into terrorists internally within Western countries and stuff like that.
Yeah, when it comes to the ones who are in the West, yeah, the ones we'd have to look out for are definitely much more the Sunni rather than the Shia, absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. Interesting.
That's one thing I've been really trying to focus on since the fall of the Islamic State is, where are they going? You know, where are these fighters going? Because that's a problem, you know, at the end of the Civil War in Yugoslavia as well, right? The jihadis didn't just, you know, go home and start baking pita bread. You know, they brought home, you know, their knowledge of war. They brought home their dedication. And then they eventually went to, a lot of them went on to Chechnya, or they went to Afghanistan, or they went, you know, they were key players in, you know, later acts of terrorism, later civil wars. And so we have to ask, you know, where are these guys going from Syria? And actually the BBC of all places did quite a good coverage of that. One of their journalists, basically followed the trail of a corridor that was created by the United States that would allow them to escape. And according to his research, a lot of them have gone to Turkey, actually. So they're now in Turkey. And what he heard is that they're planning a major attack in France. When that would happen, the nature of it, he didn't say. But I have to ask myself if some of them have made it to Bahrain for the terror attacks that they've had in the last few weeks, if we might talk a little bit about that there. They're another one of these GCC countries.
Yeah, definitely. So what do we need to know about what's happening there right now?
I mean, basically with Bahrain, you know, the country is 70 to 80% Shia. but it's ruled by a Sunni ruling family, much like the Saudi family. It's just a small island in the Persian Gulf, and it's connected to Saudi Arabia by a causeway. And what we're seeing here are Arab Spring protests in 2011, basically just calling for greater democracy and human rights. And they were met with the bullets of their police in the streets. And when the protests continued, because they so strongly outnumber the governing clan, the Saudi Arabians they drove in their American-made tanks across the causeway and started gunning down civilians as well there. And it's been just a really tough time for them since then. Now, this past year, just in the past few months, actually, Bahrain's been claiming that the Shia have turned to terrorism, and they did this after they had kicked out all independent journalists. And they're saying that they had bombed an Ashura procession, which is, we talked about this last year in our Assassin's Creed talk about the Shia and their history, how they do this remembrance of the death of Hussein, right? And that's really key to all different Shia sects. And they walk, whenever you see these, crazy pictures of people whipping themselves, blood everywhere and all that, that's an Ashura procession. Now, the thought that, a Shia terrorist is going to blow up an Ashura procession, this is like, the Unabomber starting a forest fire, or, an abortion clinic bomber would bomb a passion play. It's just something that would not happen, right?
Right.
And so I ask myself this, if you're the Bahrain intelligence services, right, and you wanted to create one of these bombs and blame it on the Shia and create, legitimize your repression of them, right? You could either have a bunch of your police dress up in civilian clothes, or your military dress up in civilian clothes and then try and go in and blow something up. That's one approach, right? The other is that you have your intelligence agent, who's running a ring of these ISIS fighters, right? You've helped them get out of a country, you've developed a rapport with them, or you appear to be part of their command and control for them, and then direct them to do this kind of an attack, and then move them out of the country, liquidate them, whatever. The second approach is so much safer from the point of view of the intelligence service that, the fact that this is happening as Syria is being emptied out of ISIS fighters, is I have to ask myself, were these ISIS fighters who were brought in to do this? They had a recent explosion of a pipeline. They had a recent shootout with police. Were these really the Shia? I doubt it. They don't have any access to these weapons. The people who have turned to violence is mostly a nonviolent protest movement that has like cricket bats and gas masks, and that's it. They've been caught with like zip guns and stuff. Right? Like homemade guns. Like they do not have the materiel and the training that Hezbollah has, right? But the Bahraini government is trying to make the case that, they are facing their own, that they're basically fighting terrorism, right? When they shoot into a crowd of protesters. And these events legitimize that process.
Yeah. Amazing.
Yeah.
Absolutely amazing. So, so there's number of countries and what seems, correct me if I'm wrong, but what seems to have been somewhat more stable situation just a few years ago has kind of, all these different fractures have kind of really come forth in the last, I'd say, year and a half, maybe 2 years. And it's becoming more evident. Is that meaning also that the Islamic world, sometimes we in the West, we think of this as a very a homogenous group that's just basically like, that they do what they can to advance Islam at the end of the day. And if that means more refugees coming to Europe and stuff like that, and if they can gain from that position by spreading Islam to other parts of the world, they will take that. But is there a chance at this point that the internal fractures are bigger than the external drive to spread Islam to the rest of the world?
Yeah, there are definitely forces within the Muslim world that have that exact goal to try and submit the entire world, especially Europe, to Islam. And these tend to be, you know, the ones who have this kind of proselytizing drive tend to be more the Muslim Brotherhood style on the softer side, and on the harder side, these, you know, Saudi-funded Wahhabi and Salafist people. And so, yeah, and I think what's happening, though, what we're seeing is the American hegemony over the area is weakening. Saudi's stability internally is weakening. The cheaper price of oil actually has hurt them a great deal and has damaged their welfare state. And they've kind of kicked the can down the road because of their consensus-based system, because they're basically ruled by, you know, men in their 80s, you know, roughly speaking, for the past few decades. You know, they have not been able to make necessary reforms to create a modern economy and so to create...
Yeah. So, sorry to interrupt, but so this is a huge... Yeah. Change with bin Salman coming in, just because of the fact that he's younger, he has some, you know, a different drive, maybe even potentially than some of these older guys do. And I mean, I'm hyper skeptical of what is happening. I don't think, you know, as we saw after this future investment initiative and the, you know, the kind of all these globalists went there, all these elites, and they were giving the thumbs up, like, great, he's reforming, things are going to happen. As you said, they're starting bringing in other industries. They're not just going to stop their dependency only on oil, which, of course, as you say, with the drop of prices has been very damaging for them, economically speaking. So I think this reformation that they're talking about, it's just a huge front, to be honest. And things could even potentially get much worse under bin Salman.
They absolutely can, and I think that they will, absolutely, yeah. And also, you know, we should always remember their goal is not the reforms themselves. Their goal is that the family holds on to power, you know.
Right.
I had a conversation, actually. I've had many conversations with this guy, but there's a member of the parliament of Bahrain who's from the Shia party there, Al-Wefaq. And he, very, very interesting. I learned a lot from talking with him. Actually, one of them was that the Ashura, he actually advocated for their Ashura processions to, instead of, you know, beating themselves bloody, everyone gives blood down at the local Red Cross as a, instead of these, you know, public shows of contrition and barbarism. Yeah. But he was considered a radical Islamist by the American State Department because he was in a Shia party. I asked a couple of things. I'll say I asked him about the connection with Iran and the fear that they would become an Iranian proxy. And he pointed out that, you know, the vast majority of their food comes across the causeway to them, and you know, Iran has already demonstrated how easy it is to turn that conduit of food into a conduit of, you know, military tanks.
Yeah.
So they would focus on their own needs as a people and not on being a proxy for Iran. And we just have to find our own way that way. I asked him about the Saudi family because he had to had some dealings with them as well. And I said, well, you know, one thing I hear is that they just have a very tribal outlook. And you have to, if you understand tribalism, you can understand them and how they think. And he said, you know, look, like if tribalism makes them wealthier and survive and protect what they have, they'll be tribal. If being an Islamist does it, they'll be an Islamist. If one day being a liberal Democrat does it, they'll be a liberal Democrat.
Exactly. It's enemies necessary for them.
And I thought, oh, come on, liberal Democrat. And here we are today. It's like, wow. Yeah.
Yeah. He's trying to do it. He's posing as that. What do you think, if any, influence the meeting that Trump did with bin Salman and when he went to Saudi Arabia? Was that anything? I mean, I've heard from some of the other alternative sources. I think even Alex Jones talked about it, that it was like somehow, you know, Trump was the back-end deals here or approving things or basically shaking things up in Saudi Arabia. I don't know. I'm skeptical, to be honest. I think that this is more or less an internal conflict that they're trying to sort out. Even though Trump was part of that weird, almost occult ceremony of opening that counterterrorism center with all the hands on the globe, like looks like some scene out of Lord of the Rings with a palantir or something. I still think it's mostly symbolic. But what's your take on that?
Well, I don't think that Saudi Arabia would embark on any major change or without getting a green light from the American administration, whichever administration it might be, regardless of party, regardless of who it is. And so I'm certainly of the belief that a vague green light for centralizing power and helping to fight Iran was given to their regime. Now, did they specifically agree to, like, oh yeah, go ahead and arrest a neighboring head of government? You know, I really doubt that that was the case, and I think that really took the White House by surprise. And I say the other thing is that, and I didn't know as much at the time of the Lebanon podcast I did on Countercurrents as I do now, but there is really a disconnect between what the State Department is saying and what the White House is saying.
Mm-hmm.
And we shouldn't be that surprised either, because you know this administration, maybe more than the other, has been so plagued by leakers and by disloyal people within who would normally just be apolitical and do what they're told, who are now, you know, running off and telling the Washington Post or cooperating in these public relations campaigns against the administration. And so, you know, it's clear that they're leaving the State Department out of the loop, and they're not calling the ambassador to Saudi Arabia to discuss certain things in meetings. Instead, he's sending Jared Kushner on.
Exactly.
To go talk with him there.
It's strange. It's like, in a way, I don't know why. And we don't hear that much critique, I think, from the mainstream media on that, too. It's like, oh, Kushner's there talking with you know, Bin Salman and stuff. And I think it would be a greater uproar about that. But again, it's just like, nope, it seems to be perfectly fine for these liberals.
He's a centrist financier, so we can trust him, right?
Yeah, exactly. Well, that's just
for the Jewish members of the White House, right?
Exactly. What is the privilege there? What is the tie-in here, then? Because the financial aspect is, of course, very interesting. As we said before, depending on, you know, oil prices and stuff, that's shake up in Saudi Arabia, and that's reversed, too. If we look at one of the princes that was arrested, Talal, right? I mean, sometimes he dresses up in a very Western outfit. He goes to America. We've even heard, actually, rumors of him raping women in Los Angeles and getting away with it and just flying out and stuff like that. There's rumors like that around him. But he was arrested on, you know, corruption charges or whatever. But I think, like, a vast amount of his huge wealth was said to be confiscated under Bin Salman now to be used for other, I guess, purposes internally. But how come this guy didn't see what was coming? If he's so wealthy and so powerful, does he not have people around in the Saudi royal house that could warn him of what was coming? It's strange, isn't it?
It is. So the beginnings of his wealth was that he, unlike, you know, most of his brothers and cousins, does have a incredible drive and has a great business sense. And he was very much involved in real estate development within Saudi Arabia, and I think in particular in Riyadh. And so he was using his family connections to get projects greenlit faster than other projects, right? And so that was the beginning of his wealth. And then he's been, you know, very wise in using it. However, his focus has been on building his business empire. And like his father before him, he has some very liberal attitudes compared to the rest of Saudi Arabia. But he has not built a governmental empire, let's say. And so that has really been the set of full brothers called the Sudayri Seven. Now, he's the son of a prince named Talal, and Talal ibn Abdulaziz. And that's why he's called Walid ibn Talal, because the way they do names is you're just your name, son of somebody, and then if it's really long, they'll say son of somebody, son of somebody, son of somebody, right? Ibn or bin, like bin Laden, right?
Yeah.
The son of Laden. Now, with him, his father believes in a constitutional monarchy. And his father was raised by a Lebanese mother and had, you know, very, you know, Western-like views compared to the others, and like so many of the Lebanese do. And he actually lived in exile for a time. And I was quite surprised, actually. I just assumed the guy had died by now. But he's actually still alive. he would be, if they were following Bedouin custom and continuing with the eldest brother, he would be the king in a couple more rounds, right? Like, just, you know, two more people have to die for him to be king.
Mm-hmm.
If they were following the old way of doing things still. And so that's actually a great threat to the rest of the princes. They can't allow that guy to be king. And so the way to get around that is to say, oh, you know, now is the time where we have to pass it to the next generation. And so, and this has been the coagulation maybe of power within this set of full brothers who share this mother from the Sudairi clan. That's why they're called the Sudairi Seven. You know, they have, I guess, 38 half-brothers or something, and they're seven full brothers. They have fallen at kind of a sweet spot in time where a lot of them held the kingship, and they shared ministerial posts amongst themselves and their nephews so that they could, and actually one who's very well known to Americans would be Bandar bin Sultan, who's actually, I think he's a brother. I could be wrong. I thought he was a brother of, he's not a brother. He's a cousin. Bandar bin Sultan, who is in the lower center of the screen there. He's actually, his mother was an African slave, actually.
Oh, really?
Yeah, they still had slavery into the 60s there.
That's funny, exactly. And people don't know that, by the way. That's a very funny
it is,
story
yeah,
to bring up. Did they still actually have slavery in those countries while we were being hammered over the head for, like, 200 years ago, you know?
Yeah. Actually, I mean, it's kind of a funny story to me, at least. Whenever I hear crap from people about, like, oh, the legacy of colonialism or what's happening with Trayvon or whatever, you know, when I was around people who lived in Dubai, you know, I'd say to them, like, guys, you live in an apartment building that was built 7 years ago by slaves from Pakistan. So, like, cut it with the lectures.
Yeah.
You know, I don't want to hear. But yeah, this guy is the son of an actual chattel slave who was bought. And he was very, very tight with the Bush family, both father and son, and he was the ambassador to the United States at the time of 9/11, and is now the head of their intelligence services. So, you know, he's just one of many examples of this sub-clan within the Saudis, the Sudairi Seven, who, you know, just collected powerful positions amongst themselves. And so, you know, Talal is on the wrong side of that family divide, right? And Walid ibn Talal is on the wrong side of that family divide. So, you know, the Sudairi Seven will get the spoils of victory. And so they're glad to support this 32-year-old who has no experience and who's, you know, and who also is bearing the blame for these bad policies and failures. Who knows who actually came up with them from the outside. But this is their path to holding on to the most power and wealth possible. And so they're taking that path.
Yeah, and
it's,
you know, just...
Yeah, very dangerous.
Definitely, exactly, very, very dangerous, and also just this idea that, and I mean, they're smart. I mean, they have to think ahead a little bit. They just can't enjoy this gravy train of the oil that they just basically accidentally happened to sit upon, and they were lucky enough that the people in the West developed the internal combustion engine, you know, so that they could reap the benefits from this resource, which they otherwise probably would never have invented something to do with themselves, regardless. It is what it is now, but they realize that basically if we don't do anything about this, the party is going to be over, right? We have to invest in new technologies, solar. That's why they're building this new city, the NEOM stuff, and they're basically trying to seek new ways of maintaining relevancy and money and resources and everything else. And I think that he, you know, Bin Salman, he I probably personally very much aware of this, but it would be maybe if he's basically able to see something which the others are not, and they decided to kind of side with him and say, you know what, he's right, he's the only one who could have vision and take the country forward or something. Otherwise, I don't know why they would allow him to do what he does and simply not just arrest him for being like a, what do you call it, like a mutiny, basically, against the royal family, right?
Well, I think they know the nature of the masses is that they need an individual to focus on. They need a cult of personality to allow a movement for change to move forward. And so he serves that purpose for them, just as Obama served the purposes of Zbigniew Brzezinski. This guy serves the purposes of this sub-clan within the Saudi royal family, serves the purposes of Israel, serves the purposes of the oligarchs in the United States.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah.
And also when we watched that, the video announcing NEOM, they have this kind of trailer video of people enjoying life in NEOM. And, you know, we see that and it's like, oh, another, more like multicultural diversity tribe that we see in every commercial.
Yeah.
But I think if you're a Saudi watching that, you're like, oh, the future of Saudi Arabia doesn't include me. Right?
Yeah, they must feel that way, right? They were like, well, what is this?
Yeah, it's like it's saying that the Saudi royal family has absolutely no faith in their subjects to learn how to create a modern economy,
yeah.
To know how to go to work and be productive and do the things that normal people everywhere else in the world do. And to some extent, they're right because, you know, they live on the subsidies from the government. Very, very few of the women work in the country. And of the men, you know, for the most part, they don't have to. And a lot of them have make-work jobs. And they just, like, sit around. I mean, they have the highest, even higher obesity rates than America, right? You know, in Kuwait and in Saudi Arabia, when you look at the actual nationals of the country.
Interesting.
And they just, they sit around, they go to shopping malls, they play video games. Their only sport is, drifting in cars. You know, it's like, they're not the future, you know. They're right to not bet on these people. And then on the other side of the coin, like if you're looking at this kind of like comfortable middle class that's just, you know, kept on essentially welfare to keep them from demanding rights, you also have in the center of the country, the Najd, all of these Wahhabis who will be the internal threat, you know. To any of these changes, and who were the source in 1979 of the people who did the mosque takeover. And so, you know, in preparing for this, I talked to everyone I could to kind of get a sense of what people were thinking about, what they were worried about, country to country. You know, Lebanese are super afraid right now, but, you know, people who lived and worked in the Emirates or not that I talked to, in Saudi Arabia, I talked to a Saudi Arabian who's about 30 years old. She moved to America when she was 28. And I mentioned that, I watched this speech. And anyone who watches Red Ice's coverage of that NEOM conference saw this, where he mentions, like, MBS says, before 1979, Saudi approach to Islam was moderate and open to other religions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
About this. You know, what do you think about that when you talk to your parents? What do they say about Saudi Arabia before 1979 and before the seizure of the mosque, or before the seizure in Mecca? And she's like, what do you mean? And I said, you know, the seizure of Mecca in 1979. And I thought, like, maybe my accent was wrong or something. I was like, you know, when they came to the Masjid al-Haram with guns. And she kind of squints her eyes at me, and I said, like, and I made the sign of guns with my hands, like, you know, guns at the Kaaba, right? It was like guns at the Kaaba. And she's like, there were never guns in the Kaaba, you know? And and I pull up the phone, and I looked up, you know, seizure of Mecca in 1979, and showed her the guys with the guns, and her eyes got so wide. You know, she lived in and went to school in Saudi Arabia from 0 to 28, and her family, born and bred, you know, in Saudi Arabia and in Jeddah, they had her husband from the eastern provinces. They had never ever heard of this happening. Never seen a picture of Juhayman, never seen the pictures of the aftermath of this. They had absolutely no idea. And so that means that the king kind of has a clean slate to rewrite history, you know, and to blame everything on this kind of fear around the time of the Iranian Revolution and the seizure of Mecca, and say that, you know, well, true Saudi Islam is this. And, you know, apart from the handful of people in the National Guard from the center of the country, maybe he can pull a fast one on them.
Yeah, exactly. Well, as we know in the West, Patrick, you know, he who controls the past controls the future.
Yeah.
And so they might use it in that way. But that's very, very interesting. So So it's a volatile situation. I don't trust that this new guy. I think it's mostly for show. It's going to just crystallize the situation with the teaming up basically with Israel. And who knows? Maybe they have some greater plan together at the end of this, or they're going to try to outmaneuver each other at the end. That remains to be seen. But for the time being, they see enough of an enemy in Iran that they want to try to get them out. So that's the potential of what we're looking at here. Definitely war, and America, of course, will back the Saudi-Israeli co-joint mission to take care of this. You know.
Absolutely, yeah, the oligarchy and the government, sadly, is a Zionist-occupied government, will be fully behind it. Yeah, and I would encourage anybody to do what they can to, organize against that and to, any kind of resistance there might be against it, anyone who might be able to throw a wrench in their machine to prevent this from working. But there definitely will be lots of chaos in the Middle East to come. It's not, I thought, oh, great, Syrian civil war is over, peace and prosperity will return.
Nope.
Sadly, no. There are some very powerful elements that don't want peace and don't want prosperity for all.
Exactly. And it might mean even more refugees also for Europe at the end of that, and for America.
Absolutely. Yes, it will. And I think that, a scenario like the one I talked about of if there is an Israeli war, well, we know this because of what happened during 2006 in France. There was a great deal of violence against Jewish communities in France. I think that would be much more deadly than ever before. And so we could see what Netanyahu wants is a much larger aliyah rate, this emigration of European Jews into Israel. I think he'll get that because they are pushing once again for war, and they have some powerful allies who also want it. And if they get that, they're going to have pretty strong push factors against Jewish communities in Europe, which that part I'm totally fine with.
It's the flip side of that just this idea that they can light the powder keg in Europe and then just take off because they have somewhere to go and we don't. And it's also this issue of, for a moment, allow me just to tie this into this rising. I mean, the mainstream media calls them alt-right, and we know that they're not. But regardless, from Steve Bannon to who now is out of the White House, admittedly, but still a very powerful player in running, Breitbart, and kind of provide and feed information to the rising new right, if we can call it that, in American politics. Kind of this, the American first that you supposedly think that Bannon would be behind, right? That he's attending together with the likes of like Laura Loomer and Jack Posobiec. They go to this Zionist Organization for America dinners and stuff like that. Now they're and one of, I listened to his speeches there, Bannon, and it was like, Iran is the biggest enemy. I'm a proud Christian Zionist and all this stuff, and so people have to be aware of that. Also from the faux right, if you will, both in America and abroad, it is this ramping up of the Muslim threat, right, that we have to, and the way to solve that, as they propose, is not to, like, stop mass immigration, but it's to basically go to war with Iran and solve it there kind of thing. So there's an undercurrent of other stuff brewing in America and Europe as well.
Yeah, that's really bad news, actually. That's very sad to hear, yeah. I don't know if I have a lot of insight on this or not to talk about, and we talked about it a bit before the show. McMaster, who is now the National Security Advisor, he took over for Flynn. And, Flynn, there's a lot that he said that I really liked. I didn't read his book, but there was a lot that he said that I liked. He talked about how we actually have to name the enemy if we want to take out the enemy. But, he had his links with Michael Ledeen. He co-wrote his book with Michael Ledeen, who's one of the, main neocons. I think he was actually a charter member of the of PNAC, right, the Project for a New American Century.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. He was definitely had his beginnings in the Iran-Contra affair. McMaster had about a two-week campaign against him that was being run by Alex Jones and Cernovich and Breitbart and a number of others trying to take him out. And then they gave up, basically. And today is the first day I've seen something attacking him again. And it just so happens it's the same day that Saudi Arabia is calling for sanctions and action against Iran and against Lebanon.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to ask myself, is this a coincidence? Am I making connections here that are not, or that are there? Because McMaster will be a voice of reason and calm in the room there when they're discussing, well, are we going to allow bombs to fall on Hezbollah? Do we give the green light for that to Saudi Arabia? Are we going to, you know, to drop this deal with Iran? It's just, it's not smart to do. You know, it's fine to be, the Iranian foreign minister had this line. He said that being unpredictable can be valuable to you in diplomacy and in foreign policy, but being unreliable is not.
Mm-hmm.
And so backing out of a deal that's already been signed, that's already being implemented, and that's already been successful is, in the long run, would hurt the United States, even with, you know, not just with Iran, but any country that makes a deal. It's like every promise is going to have an expiration date on it.
Yeah.
From that point on. And so that's a problem, yeah. And Iran is not the axis of evil. I mean, the axis of evil to me is Israel and Saudi Arabia.
It's yep.
The people who are facilitating the degeneration of European culture and the invasion of Europe, and the people who are, you know, revving up and funding these Wahhabi and Salafi terrorists.
Indeed.
And sometimes it's both. Sometimes Israel is involved in that second part as well. This is the axis of evil. This is the greatest source of evil in the world today.
Yeah.
And that's what he bought. And it's very sad to see that, you know, that America, France, the UK, Germany, they all seem to be on the wrong side of this.
I know. It's true. It's very worrying.
Yeah.
You know, and that dialogue among the rising tide of nationalism in Europe of, kind of pro-Israeli, completely blinded by this issue is very worrying that it's so few in the mainstream. And I can't help to also perceive that a lot of the influencers, whatever that's, and I'm talking to the lower levels now, but those are basically our gateways from taking questioning people out there that have discontent with the system, wondering what's going on. They can see the problems with liberalism, SJWs, and all that kind of stuff.
Right.
But then where do they end up? Right? What's the input feed there? It is people like, unfortunately, because they're allowed on Fox now and stuff like that. But it is the Laura Loomers, the Cernovich, the Pisoviks, right. You know, that's like this kind of middle layer. But at the end of the day, kind of, you know, critique us for wanting to have European nations for European people, but they're perfectly fine having Israel for Jewish people, right?
Yes.
And so that double standard is there, and they're taking us just to focus, and even Molyneux is guilty of this, Alex Jones is guilty of this. It's like Islam is the problem, and how, at the end of the day, different is that from the neocon kind of talking points, you know? Not that different, to be honest.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, I've always had nothing but nice things to say about Jared Taylor, for example. You know, I have a great deal of differences of opinion with him, but he's someone who is not, he's a stepping stone, not a gatekeeper. And it's not also to say there are people who come to his opinions and stay there as well. And, you know, I respect them for that, you know, as well. It's not to say that I'm, yeah, everyone who agrees with me has reached a higher level, and they're not there yet.
Sure, sure.
But you know that there are amicable relations between us, and that we allow a free exchange of ideas, and we're not trying to keep people out of each other's camp, basically. But yeah, there are those who are gatekeepers, on the other hand, and they may on paper be the exact same as someone like Jared Taylor, or they may on paper be exactly the same as someone like Pat Buchanan, right? But they will do everything they can to denounce us or pretend we don't exist to basically serve some other purpose than the ideas they profess.
Yeah, and I feel it's this channeling of discontent, an understandable grassroots anger that's building against the establishment. And I mean, we could argue, we don't have to go into that too much in this particular interview here in this show, but, you know, some argues that Trump is part of that, and although he's brought in a refreshing change in many regards, his, frankly, willingness, I guess for lack of a better term, to kind of fall in line right with what General Wesley Clark, the ex-NATO commander, suggested that he had overheard in the Pentagon many years ago. They were talking about a number of countries that they were going to take out, and Iran was, of course, at the pinnacle of that, and Trump has been vehemently anti-Iran. So, you know, although there's a positive change with Trump and a very, you know, economically speaking, good America first kind of policy, but at the end of that foreign policy, it's a very worrying aspect, and that has to be continued pointed out, that where is this going to lead, right? And all these people that are advocating for just Islam being the problem, that could drag us into a massive war, America I'm talking about now, a massive war, which would just be catastrophic on so many levels.
Yeah, it would be. Yeah, Iran is going to be far more difficult a country to deal with than Iraq.
Yeah, it's not Iraq, you know.
Size, number of people, military technology, and also the hearts of the people.
And then Russia and China back in them.
Yes.
Probably, yeah. Definitely Russia.
It would be a total disaster, I believe. As far as Trump goes, you know, I think he's kind of just like the, if you know the New York Post, you know, he's kind of a New York Post Republican in a sense. And this kind of view about Iran would be part of that. That, you know, kind of like a populist style, but on certain issues like this, they take that stand there. What's most shocking though is Alex Jones to see after the attack on after the, you know, the bombings of the airbase in Syria last spring by Trump, that he was, you know, sounding like Sean Hannity at the peak of the Iraq War, saying that Obama was a pussy and, you know, Bashar Assad deserved it anyway because of the chemical attacks. And I was like, whoa, what happened to Alex Jones? You know, and to hear him now when, you know, when he has someone who actually has excellent experience and knowledge like Steve Pachenik on his show. And as soon as he says anything critical of Trump, Alex Jones just gets very, very nervous around him, and prefers to go to his, you know, to Roger Stone, who I haven't seen him do a show sober in months. But he comes on with some, you know, it's like, oh, Trump is being poisoned. Trump is, you know, what are they talking about?
Yeah, I know it's different agendas here, you know, folks. At the end of the day, and because I think at the, as we've been talking about and kind of laying out here and structuring, I think that, you know, they're painting themselves into a corner, because what I've noticed is that they've talked down on Saudi Arabia for so many years, but now we can clearly see the alignment of these powers in the Middle East coming together with Israel at the very pinnacle of that. So, you know, if they're critical of Saudi Arabia, then at some point, you know, they're not joined at the hip, but at some point in their co-joint attack on Iran, you have to question which side you're on here, or the fence, you know?
Yes, yeah, absolutely. And also, I mean, Saudi Arabia just, you know, has so much money in the American system. They, you know, after I did the podcast on the Qatar crisis, I noticed that whenever I went on the Washington Post, I see ads for some documentary about how Qatar stole the World Cup. That they bribed FIFA officials, and they stole it from America, actually. It would have been in America had not the Qataris bribed FIFA officials. And it's like, you know, Saudi Arabia, I heard it was $450 million just this year on public relations in Washington, D.C.
Yeah.
And so it's like, yeah, the orders for that documentary must have come direct from Saudi Arabia, because they – would have to imagine that people care about soccer to make it. And they're telling these people in D.C., these lobbying firms, to make this video, and they're like, oh, sure, yeah, the check cleared, why not, you know?
Yeah, and that's right, I've heard that. There's a tremendous amount of firms that are working there. In some cases, there's money going direct to, you know, middle, in-between company, but it's basically coming into different politicians and stuff like that. And And, you know, for years the distinction was made. I mean, I've even heard someone like Alex Jones talking about how, you know, the Saudis own the movie industry, funny things like this. But it's funny that the lines begin to blur more and more, it feels like, between the Israel and Saudi, you know, that difference, the Wahhabists and the Zionists, that lines begin to blur more and more the deeper into this we go.
Yeah, they have a strong alignment of interest, and we don't notice it as much in D.C. when we look there because their tactics are so different. You won't see a big convention center rented out with Nancy Pelosi showing up and who else, you know, name any politician showing up and saying how there should be an American embassy in Jerusalem. These things they do with the AIPAC. You know, you won't have like Israel Day or Israel Week with people showing up in blue T-shirts on Capitol Hill for Saudi Arabia. You know, they don't do things the same way. It's just money behind the scenes, what they think are slick ad campaigns and just outright buying of influence. And also, you know, buying, you know, big business deals, just buying tons of weapons. And they tried it recently with Russia to give them $100 billion to buy actually a very high tech anti-missile system, which would be very important, game changer in the region, but also to buy natural gas from them. Like, that's crazy. They're buying, it's like they say, selling your fridge to an Eskimo. It's like,
bizarre. Yeah. Well, these deals are made as amicable kind of issues. But one thing quickly that we left out about Talal is obviously that he owns massive. I mean, you did mention it, but just more directly, his ownership in Twitter, which is also going, you know, through this huge reform right now, and Fox and many other companies. I think Apple too. He had a big share in and stuff like that. So. You know, depending on what happens to him, I know that the king of Saudi Arabia had to write personally to some of these companies just to stabilize the stock market and the worry that they had. Like, okay, well, what's going to happen to our assets now? If this guy's gone and he owns so much of it, what do we do? So we'll see what happens there if someone takes over his wealth or if it goes back into the sovereign wealth fund of Saudi Arabia or something. I don't know. We'll just have to see. It's interesting.
Well, and it goes to show that, you know, Saudis only have friends that they pay for, because you'd think that Fox would step up and say something about one of their biggest shareholders is in jail, is basically, you know, held in detention by his family in Saudi Arabia. You'd think they'd see that as newsworthy and try to mobilize people against it, you know, the way they mobilized against Keurig K-cups for right?
Right. Yeah, exactly.
No, that didn't happen. No, that was something that was a commentary that was heard a lot about this Arab League meeting today, is that, you know, it really, there was something a bit absurd about it, to see Saudi Arabia there calling for this meeting to say that, you know, the greatest threat to stability in the region is Iran, and to say, like, look, if money was not an issue, would anybody else show up to that meeting? And the answer is no. You know, they have no actual friends. And that's the sad thing is, the longer the United States and Europe continues to pursue relationships and allows these outside players to manipulate us through the weak structures of our system, right? That we have elections that cost money, and that they have this money they can pump into them. That we have this disconnect between the people we elect to make decisions and their interests and the interests of the people. And that's being manipulated by these outside players. Continue going down that road, and we'll find ourselves in the same situation, that the only friends we have are the ones we pay for. Whereas, you know, Russia, on the other hand, you know, during the time of the Warsaw Pact, you know, they had allies, but these were allies who were basically looking up the barrel of a gun at their senior partner. And so they're not willing allies. This is something I heard. Yeah, Stephen Cohen, who's a Russia expert, and he's actually a pretty straight shooter and has been for a long time. And he's a professor from, I think, Columbia. And he was pointing this out, that for so long, you know, they had unwilling allies and no new friends. Whereas now we find, you know, Saudi Arabia showing up, knocking on their door. Turkey showing up now, knocking on their door. you know, everyone who's part of their client states, right, or their client groups are willing clients. You know, they're happy to have them as a patron. They're happy to have them as a trading partner and as a diplomatic ally. Their situation has changed greatly, even though they're still, in terms of wealth, much, much less, right? Diplomatically speaking, their situation has changed greatly. And unfortunately for the United States, I think it's going in the direction, the same direction Saudi Arabia and Israel is going in. Their only friends are those they pay for.
Mm-hmm. Yep, it's true. All right, well, what should we cover here at the end, Patrick? I think it's important to squeeze in that people should know about the situation if there's anything that we've left out.
Well, I'm going to do a podcast in the near future on the demographics of the Arab world. And I think there are a lot of surprises in store for people in that. And that is that they really are going through the demographic transition and having much fewer kids per family. And that's actually, this whole period that we're in right now, starting slightly before the Arab Spring and extending through 2030, is something that the CIA wrote about in reports already. They do National Defense Initiative, maybe? I forget. National Defense Estimate. National Intelligence Estimate, thank you. NIE, National Intelligence Estimate. And they try to look out 15 years ahead. And anyway, this period we're living in now, they call the Age of Instability, because the Arab world is going through this transition, and also because of, in the near future, the problem for access to water will become a big issue in many of these countries because of their rising populations. And these kinds of resource wars will be more and more common, was their prediction. And sectarian divides and other kind of divides would be exacerbated by this strain on resources.
And do you know why they were right?
Yes, looks like they're right. Yeah, that's
because,
what they called.
Because they're behind most of it, that's why.
Yeah.
They're pulling and pushing the threads too. There was this great scene in X-Files, this not the smoking man, but another gentleman that works with this, you know, conglomerate of conspirators. He's saying the best way to predict the future is to control it and make it yours. You know, and that's why we're seeing so much meddling and so much intense intelligence work and behind the scenes, and it's very worrying, but. So that's interesting, though, with the demographics. I know that Saudi Arabia, in that particular scenario, has a huge young population. There was another reason, too, why apparently bin Salman did what he did here with this reform and bringing in other investors, building robotics and solar cells and solar plants and stuff like that. It's because they need to give some of the young people work, basically. There's, like, nothing to do, you know?
Yes, exactly, yeah. Yeah, and as well, I think that the demographic in terms of age in Saudi Arabia, that profile now looks very similar to Iran in the late 70s.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And so that's a cause for concern. And so that's why, yeah, they have to address their needs and issues. But also at the same time, you know, that doesn't make the problem go away, because if you get people's hopes up and then you fail to deliver, when you're a one-man show, which is what, you know, MBS will be, he may sink as quickly as the last MBSs that we followed, those mortgage-backed securities. Bubble might pop on him as well.
Exactly. Yeah, there's a lot of pressure, on him on delivering some of these promises and what he'll be able to do.
Yeah.
But again, if he's... I'm not saying that he personally isn't, you know, driving this or whatever, but if he's more merely a front, a face, a PR campaign for this new reformed Saudi Arabia, which is really pulled by a lot of other interests and objectives and stuff like that, then they might be able to pull it off unless it's just hinging on him. And I know that that's kind of how they do things in Saudi Arabia, but again, if we're to believe that he's meeting with all these other powerful leaders, he's given the go-ahead and the thumbs up and, yes, man, go ahead, please do this. He probably has a network at this point that he's tied into of people around the world, the elite, the globalists that are approving of him. And if they weren't, they probably, he wouldn't get very far. He wouldn't be allowed to do what he's doing.
Yes, yeah, and I think it's working as well. That young lady I mentioned who had never heard of the mosque seizure in 1979, for her husband, and also they were guessing for their friends back home, their attitude is basically any kind of change is welcome. That just, it has to change. The status quo is totally unacceptable. So even, you know, these kinds of extrajudicial arrests of all these princes, all the, you know, all this other stuff to them is palatable because it means that it's the end of the status quo. So I don't think she's alone in thinking that, and this is clearly what's driving this regime to take so many risks right now, and also to go from loss to loss and continue to take more risks. So I hope everyone tunes in to the White Nationalist Guide to the Middle East. We've had, I think, three great episodes so far and more to come over at Countercurrents. That's counter-currents.com. You know, I'd encourage everybody to support independent media like Red Ice, like Countercurrents, because, you know, we are all being attacked right now. And in order to survive, we need your support. And then I'd say as well, just keep organizing locally. Think of, you know, creative ways that you can disrupt the oligarchy and prepare for the day when we can finally replace this thing. And I guess if I were to say one last thing, it's okay to be white.
It's okay to be white. Very good way of ending this. This is absolutely right, Patrick. Yeah, thank you so much for that and for those kind words about, you know, our broadcast and others, such as, you know, what you guys are doing at Countercurrents and stuff like that. Many others are trying and working hard, and obviously the attack is immense at this point in terms of what they're trying to do to silence these alternative sources of information, especially those that come from a pro-European perspective and a white advocacy perspective. That is the forbidden area of our times, and so it's not pretty what's happening. So we'll see what happens with all these platforms, but I do, as you said, I encourage people to take the opportunity now to get contact details for people that you are connected with on social media and stuff like that, because Twitter is going to start booting people off. Facebook already has. YouTube might even do it soon. We just don't know where this is heading. They're trying to choke us out, and that's why it's super important for people out there to support the kind of work that we do, because we won't be able to do it without the support of you guys out there. So thank you for doing that, and thank you, Patrick, again for coming on and helping us to understand a little bit better about what it is that's happening in the Middle East and what we can expect in the future. So thanks so much.
All right, thank you.
Well, thank you for watching or listening today. We'll be back with more shortly. Jay Dyer on the death of Charles Manson and what really actually drove this guy to do what it did and who's behind him. We have a bunch more new videos, too. If you only get the radio RSS feed to your device, make sure that you go to redice.tv and go to our TV section on the website. Don't miss all the videos that we have there for you, as you won't be able to watch those and catch those in the radio podcast feed. So tons of additional stuff on the website for you. Well, also, thank you, everyone, for your support. We are importing all the shows into the new members' website this week. We're getting ready to launch here very soon. I just want to say thank you to every member that has sustained their membership with us. We would literally have not been able to survive without our members, our member support, and those who have donated as well. We are going to run a new, you know, drive once RedIceMembers.com is up and going live. So please sign up and please donate so that we can take care of our team and continue to produce videos that will wake people up and tell them the truth about what the elites are doing. This is literally a seminal point in history that we're in right now. We are being hit with everything they got. Censorship, removal, deletion, shadow banning. They're preventing information from spreading and getting out to more people. They are going to let the internet service providers here eventually decide what websites that you can see and use. The net neutrality issue is going out the window, it looks like, coming up later this week. With the new FCC rules and proposals. So this is it. This is the pushback, and it's only up to you to make the call if we are to be able to be here and provide a dissident counterposition. And I know that we have to go in the opposite direction. We have to grow and expand. We can't back down at this point. It's impossible. So we are here ready to fight for you and fight harder than ever, but without your help, we can't do it. That's just reality. So thank you for your support, for helping us to fight back. We will talk to you soon. Take good care. We'll see you on the next one.